This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Russian President Vladimir Putin says the West has undermined the global economy with its futile attempt to isolate Moscow with sanctions. More Israeli atrocities: regime forces kill a young Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. Plus, a deadly wildfire in Southern California forces thousands of people to flee their homes. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Russian President Vladimir Putin says it will be impossible for the West to isolate Russia, even with the toughest of its sanctions.
However, the epidemic has been replaced by other challenges, also global in its nature, threatening the entire world. I'm referring to the sanctions fever of the West, its blatant, aggressive attempts to impose patterns of behavior on other countries, to deprive them of their sovereignty and to bend them to its will.
Putin said Russia is facing economic, financial, and technological aggression from the West, but the economic situation has stabilized in general. The Russian president blamed the West for undermining the global economy by trying to impose its hegemony. The Russian president made the remarks at an economic forum in the far eastern city of Vladivostok. The U.S. and its allies have imposed a host of sweeping sanctions against Russia since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. Russian citizens planning to travel to the European Union will have to pay a lot more and wait much longer for their visas to process. EU Commission is planning to more than double the visa fees and prolong the application process for Russians. The Commission is also proposing that the EU states refuse to recognize Russian passports that have been issued in occupied territories of Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has reacted by calling the proposal, quote, another ridiculous decision in a series of ongoing absurdities. Tensions between the EU and Moscow have been escalating in recent weeks. Russia switched off the gas supply to EU, blaming sanctions for the interruptions and saying the flow can only be fully resumed once the sanctions are lifted. And the United States turns down a push by Ukraine to label Russia a state sponsor of terrorism, saying that it would be counterproductive.
It is not the most effective or strongest path forward, as we have said many times before, to hold Russia accountable. This designation could have unintended consequences to Ukraine and the world.
The White House press secretary added that the decision would hamper aid delivery to war zones or prevent grain shipments out of Ukraine's blockaded ports. Earlier, President Joe Biden simply replied no to reporters who were pushing him for an answer over the designation. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been calling on Western countries to formally designate Russia a terrorist state, but Moscow has warned that any such move would rupture the relations with Washington. A Ukrainian nationalist website has grabbed the headlines in recent months for openly releasing a kill list comprising of hundreds of people it deems to have aided pro-Russia forces in some way. Numerous journalists, public figures, and citizens have been murdered since being put on the list, including journalist Daria Dugina, the daughter of Russian dignitary Alexander Dugin. Johnny Miller, who recently was in Ukraine to cover the war, has also been put on the list. He's talked about the kill list to a press conference held by the Moscow-based Foundation to Battle Injustice, which investigates war crimes and atrocities committed by Ukrainian nationalists and neo-Nazis.
What this list does is it stifles a serious debate within Ukrainian society. If you're a journalist or you're a blogger or you're a political figure or you're a citizen in Ukraine who wants to criticize extremism in Ukraine, of which there's a lot of, or if you want to criticize Ukrainian government policy, most likely you're going to be put on that list. and under serious threat of death. Any of us journalists who went to Western Ukraine now would be under serious threat of our lives, and that's putting it mildly. There are so many people in Ukraine who want to have a push for peaceful negotiations with Russia. So many people. I've been to Kiev, I've been to Odessa. So many people in Ukraine want to start peaceful negotiations to end this war. And of course, peaceful negotiations at the moment would mean ceding some territory, whether it's Crimea, Donbass, etc. But if anybody in Ukrainian society wants to stand up and push this line, which is popular amongst many Ukrainians, they're most likely going to be on that list. But that's the level of danger in Ukrainian society now. I have a journalist friend in Kiev who recently told me she went out to a social event with some work colleagues. And at that social event, somebody there voiced an opinion, not pro-Russia, but not significantly anti-Russian enough. And her work colleague turned to her and said, "If you ever say something like that, I will kill you and your family." And that's the state of many parts of Ukraine now, that even at a social event, a work colleague can threaten death upon you and your family for voicing an opinion that is not with the orthodoxy of the authorities. And the extremism, Mirat Verets is very much a symbol or a symptom of the extremist elements in Ukraine at the moment.
The Israeli military has been stepping up its violent attacks against Palestinians across the occupied West Bank in recent weeks. We've received reports about Israeli soldiers killing yet another Palestinian during a confrontation at a refugee camp earlier today. We've asked our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, to tell us the details of what happened. Here's what she said.
Israeli troops stormed the refugee camp of Farah near Tuba, central the occupied West Bank, and Israeli troops shot and seriously wounded, let's say, 21-year-old Ghassan, Yunus Ghassan Tayyip from Al-Farah refugee camp, while he was being transferred to hospital. Palestinian paramedics declared that he succumbed to his injuries. The Israeli military issued a statement claiming that Israeli Davidan troops, let's say these elite Israeli military, raided, they claim, one of the Palestinians threw Molotov cocktails at the Israeli forces raiding the refugee camp of Al-Farah, and they opened fire at those Palestinians or this Palestinians and killed him.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip have held a big rally to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break. A year ago, six Palestinians humiliated the Israeli regime through their daring and heroic escape from the Gilboa maximum security prison. Nasha Shannon has more in this report.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to mark the first anniversary of the Gilboa prison break, also known as the Freedom Tunnel operation. In September of last year, six Palestinian detainees escaped from the Gilboa maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine. They managed to get out through an underground tunnel in the prison's drainage system. Hamas resistance movement has vowed to secure the release of Palestinian detainees.
On the first anniversary of the heroic Gilboa escape operation, we salute the six prisoners. Securing the release of all prisoners is a top priority for Palestinian resistance factions. The six escapees will be on top of the list of any future prisoner swap deals with the Zionist entity.
The Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Israeli prison service keeps Palestinian inmates under deplorable conditions. The prisoners have also been subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Palestinian prisoners escape from Israeli prisons because of the horrible detention conditions. They suffer from inhumane treatment, and hundreds of prisoners are held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention.
Palestinian prisoners regularly go on hunger strikes and protest at the regime's administrative detention policy and harsh conditions. Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
We call on all international human rights organizations to step in and protect Palestinian prisoners. There are thousands of prisoners, including children and women, in Israeli custody. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from all forms of oppression inside Israeli jails.
Currently, around 5,000 Palestinians, including children and women, are languishing inside Israeli jails.
People here consider Palestinians held in Israeli jails as political prisoners and freedom fighters who continue to struggle under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
And in California, rapidly spreading fires left at least two people dead and pushed officials to order thousands to flee. The Fairview fire has consumed over 1,000 hectares. In less than 24 hours, the blaze has destroyed several buildings. More than 3,000 homes are under orders to evacuate, and all local schools have been shuttered. The cause of the fire is under investigation. California is going through a ferocious heat wave, with temperatures of 43 Celsius being recorded daily in several areas. That, coupled with the two-decade drought that has left the region tinder dry, is creating ideal conditions for explosive wildfires. Just hours after being appointed as the UK's new Prime Minister, Liz Truss unveils her new cabinet lineup in a major reshuffle. Among her most senior appointments are Kwasi Kwarteng as Chancellor, James Cleverly as Foreign Secretary, and Suella Braverman as Home Secretary. Ahead of the announcement, several high-profile ministers resigned, including Home Secretary Priti Patel. Truss has dropped all those who backed her rival Rishi Sunak. She's succeeding Boris Johnson, who tendered his resignation to the Queen earlier on Tuesday. Johnson stepped down as a Conservative Party leader 2 months ago after losing the support of lawmakers over back-to-back failures and scandals.
Finally, after weeks of divisive debates and bitter infighting, Britain's ruling Conservative Party has elected a new leader, Liz Truss, who also goes on to become the next Prime Minister, ending a power vacuum at number 10, which led to public fear and economic uncertainty. Truss was officially appointed after meeting Queen Elizabeth II at Balmoral Tuesday morning. Her predecessor, Boris Johnson, had earlier issued his final speech outside number 10 ahead of resigning his post.
This is it, folks. Thank you, everybody, for coming out so early this morning. In only a couple of hours, I will be in Balmoral to see Her Majesty the Queen. And the torch will finally be passed to a new Conservative leader.
Truss has secured the faith of the Tory membership. However, polling suggests the Conservatives have lost favour with the wider electorate. But Truss supporters believe she has what it takes to turn things around.
Liz Truss wasn't responsible for the mess that the country is now in. Indeed, Rishi Sunak, her rival as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he was behind many of the policies which involved an increase in the national insurance, basically a tax on jobs, and of course inflationary policies that have exacerbated the crisis that Britain is currently in. So Liz Truss will be a new broom that will come in and perhaps sweep up the mess that Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, her predecessor as Prime Minister, created.
Allegations have been spread of a possible plan by Boris on returning to power, agitating from the backbenches to undermine Truss's leadership, as he did under David Cameron and Theresa May.
Boris Johnson, to be honest, I met him and he is like unpredictable. He can do anything. I think at the moment he will be away for a while, but he must have a plan. Always he have a plan. Boris, he like stay for a little while, then he have something else. So he's not going to stop for sure.
Truss's first big challenge will be dealing with the cost of living crisis. She's pledged a clear plan within a week, with expectations of a cap freeze on energy bills. But winter looms and bills remain eye-wateringly high.
Even before Truss took office, speculation has swirled regarding whether she has what it takes or not to save the economy, fight off backbench criticism, and also to hold on to power for the Conservatives in a general election, the next being scheduled for January 2025, meaning that Truss will have to make a meaningful impact and quickly in order to hold on to her position at number 10 for the long term. Robert Carter, London.
In Canada, a manhunt is still underway for a surviving suspect 3 days after a deadly stabbing rampage. Police say the suspect remains at large and is possibly wounded. They've been asking people to take precautions following the Sunday attacks that shook the nation to the core. The suspect is one of two brothers accused of committing the violence in Saskatchewan province. Police have found the body of the other brother in an Indigenous reserve where the attacks started. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the knife attacks as shocking and heartbreaking. He says violent incidents have become all too commonplace in Canada. At least 10 people were stabbed to death and 18 more injured in several locations. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has landed in a new controversy after accusing the government of plotting to appoint what he called a favorite as the next army chief. Pakistan's military shot back at Imran Khan, calling his statements defamatory. Nasser Kazmi has more in this report.
Pakistan's coalition government has shot back at former Prime Minister Imran Khan after he accused the government of delaying fresh elections to appoint a new military chief of its own choice to cover up what he called corruption in high places and high-profile officials' ill-gotten wealth. Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif says those intending to hurt the bond between the armed forces and the people of country are not friends of Pakistan. Khan, who was deposed by a legislative no-confidence vote in April, has been staging massive rallies of his party supporters nationwide to press for early general elections, saying that his government was overthrown through a conspiracy hedged by the United States.
They want to bring in an army chief of their choice because they have stolen away money. They fear that if a strong, patriotic army chief is appointed, he will question them about their stolen wealth.
As per the law in country's constitution, Pakistan's prime minister has the authority to appoint new army chief. Pakistan's powerful military chief, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, is scheduled to complete his term in mid-November. The prime minister has to pick the new military head for the next 3 years from a list of generals submitted by the outgoing chief. While terming Khan's statement as unfortunate and disappointing, both the coalition government and the powerful military have denounced the charges labeled by the former prime minister. The government says that a long legal battle would be initiated against Imran Khan very soon. While chairing a cabinet meeting to discuss a future strategy on Imran Khan's statements, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif said those trying to draw a wedge between masses and armed forces of the country are not loyal to Pakistan.
Imran Khan is not the only political leader who has blamed military establishment for interfering in political matters. But given Khan's popularity, the military is not taking his criticism lightly. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The European countries may finally find a solution for their energy crisis. They may resort to old-fashioned ways of burning coal or animal waste to get their homes warm or keep their factories working. But after that, they'd better look for a solution for their political independence from the US. How is it possible that the U.S. acts in whatever way it desires, but Europeans pay for U.S. irresponsible actions. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. Global Times wrote, the European Union has collectively committed itself to a long proxy conflict against Russia, despite being critically energy dependent on oil and gas imports from Russia. If, however, you listen to the words of their top bureaucrats, such as Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, one might never believe there is any problem. They talk about reducing energy dependency on Moscow as a quick and painless process, but things haven't been going to plan. Far from crushing Russia, Moscow has been able to make record amounts of revenue in energy exports and reducing the flow of natural gas supplies to Europe, leading to an astronomical surge in energy prices, which poses to throw the Europe continent into a state of economic crisis. Worse still, winter is coming, meaning that demand and cost are only set to increase further. Germany is already rolling out measures to ration the use of electricity, such as demanding all electronic advertising be turned off at night, heating for private pools banned, and limiting use of air conditioners. As the skyrocketing prices of bills hurt consumers, political unrest and discontent is proliferating across the continent, especially given the war in Ukraine is the root cause of all of it, something leaders are simply expecting their populations accept. In the Czech Republic over the weekend, over 70,000 marched in Prague against the EU, NATO, and the energy crisis over the conflict in Eastern Europe, with its government having survived a vote of no confidence over the crisis. Protests throughout Germany are being planned by Die Linke, the left party against the fuel crisis. In Cologne, over 2,000 already marched recently demanding elected officials to put their energy needs over the support for Ukraine. The emerging discontent is the only tip of the iceberg, which will sap the political impetus of leaders throughout the continent to continue fueling the conflict unabashedly. After all, if European leaders cannot readily convince their own populations to abide by COVID restrictions or accept vaccines for their own good, what chance do they stand in compelling them to continue making sacrifices for a conflict that is not theirs? What makes matters worse is that European leaders more readily sacrifice Nord Stream 2, which would have been a solution to this crisis, at a whim on long-standing pressure, coercion and bullying from the US, a country who makes a huge profit out of this crisis through its own natural gas exports, while nonetheless refusing to help in this area. This paints a grim picture for Europe, who will now face a brazen winter of discontent as their own populations grow angry, cold, bitter, frustrated, and out of pocket with the frenzied support of Ukraine at all cost. A crunch is coming. Time also wrote, until blackouts begin or pump prices make driving actually unaffordable, most people generally think no more often of energy than of air. For this reason, Americans have mostly been sheltered from the energy crisis unfolding urgently and in some cases lethally in countries around the world. In many other places, especially Europe, the escalating situation is impossible to ignore and is going to get a lot worse. As a consequence of the rising cost of input fuels, benchmark electricity prices in Europe have surged almost 300% in 2022, breaking records. Taken together, energy prices are 10 times higher than the 5-year average. Not only do average households struggle to pay for power and heating at such a cost, but governments are coming up short too. The $279 billion European governments have recently allocated to help small consumers is already not enough. Britain's National Energy Action Charity projects an increase from 4.5 million UK households to a full 8.5 million will face energy poverty this winter. Kosovo is already suffering rolling blackouts, 2 hours off for every 6 hours on. Brown and blackouts are also expected in other European countries.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Liz Truss is officially UK's next prime minister. While her nomination is certainly not the envy of the town, there are many who are questioning her leadership abilities. For example, when it comes to foreign policy. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what her approaches will be and have been on some hot-button issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the Ukraine conflict, UK's relationship with the Persian Gulf countries. For example, will she put arms sales ahead of human rights? And also what she thinks about Iran and the JCPOA revival talks or the sanctions removal talks. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Hafsakara Mustafa joins us. She's a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Also joining us, President of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Hafsakara Mustafa, if I may. Taking a look at what Liz Truss will be facing in the foreign policy arena, I'm guessing the Ukraine conflict or Russia's special military operation would be probably at the top of the list. What kind of approach do you think she would take on that issue, you think?
Well, it's difficult to say, but I mean, given the examples she's given in the past as foreign secretary, I think we can fairly assume that it's not going to be a positive role or one of good leadership. She's shown herself to be a political lightweight with very little knowledge of the intricacies of foreign policy. And I think in this delicate time where any word can be interpreted and escalate a very volatile situation, I think she's obviously not a very good candidate. But of course, I think in some way, I think Russia is going to be very pleased with this nomination because it will actually add weight to their argument and the kind of politicians that they're putting on the stage. So if you put, for instance, Lavrov compared to Ms. Truss, I think you can see that Russia comes out far more stronger and has the ability to project itself as a firm and actually important international leader. And I think on that front, it puts actually Britain in a very weak spot because Britain has literally chosen as PM somebody who has very little knowledge of foreign policy. And I think at this time, it's very alarming.
What do you think, Mahmoud Rafah? Do you agree with what Hafsikar Mustafa has said there? What are your views on the way that Liz Truss may or may not approach the way the conflict in Ukraine is actually developing?
Well, let me, with all my respect to my colleague, but let me highlight very important and explicit reality. The European Union countries and in front of them or on top of them, UK, number one, since 1945, the end of Second World War, are not really decision makers. The states of the European Union are not real decision makers in specific cases. One of these cases is the relationship with the other side of the world, in particular the Soviet Union and its heritage, somehow Russia now. They are not real decision makers. Also in the terrorism, also in negotiations with Iran, etc. In some cases, in the big lines, we can say, they are not the real decision makers. The real decision makers are the Americans. Orders come from Washington, D.C. And somehow, in some stages, we saw Jacques Chirac of France treating the things of invasion of Iraq differently. But at the end of the day, it's the whole European Union will not go out of the frame of the United States. And United States, and especially when I say United States, the administration of President Biden is insisting to face Russia in Ukraine until the last soldier of Ukraine, okay, as President Putin said. I agree with this phrase so much. So that's why I do not imagine any European country will go out of this dilemma and to have an independent situation. We saw here in France, President Biden at the beginning, President Macron, sorry, at the beginning, how he wanted to get out and to overcome this issue, especially France and Russia. They have both very historical relationships since the Caesarian Russia, before the Soviet Union. That's why they have this relationship has its own specificity, uh-huh, but he could not. We saw the German politicians as well, how they got broken, literally broken, when they wanted to raise their voice, oh, hey, let us be aside. We will be damaged and hurt seriously, especially with the gas. They were broken, all politicians who took this approach. So I don't imagine, at the end of the day, Europe will have its own independent situation,
sure,
far away from the American situation.
Hafsikar Mustafa, this special relationship is something that has defined and has been described when it comes to the UK and the US. And it was surprising to me, looking at some of the coverage of this issue, which actually has turned out to be somewhat not as cordial when it comes to Liz Truss. It seems, based on, for example, this one particular source, where it said that she needed the Russian president to suffer a strategic defeat. But the U.S. has actually backed a little bit away from that talk about my defeat of Russia. And if you remember when Joe Biden talked about how the Russian president needs to go, and then people said, well, he's advocating for regime change, and the White House had to backtrack on that. Do you think, and there's some other points that she's made on that, but how do you view it? Is Liz Truss an advocate of this special relationship with the U.S.?
I'm sorry, the sound has come and gone, so I've missed part of what you were asking. But I think in general, if we note that the reaction from the US has been more or less subdued, I think it's because overall, everyone accepts, and I think in Britain first and foremost, that Liz Truss is really a sort of transitional prime minister. We know that the Tory mandate has two more years to go, and therefore in replacement of Boris Johnson, she's got two more years to go. And as a result, I don't think we can imagine some sort of long-term strategy and some sort of mandate that will establish the trust doctrine in future years to come. Hence why there's very little reaction, very little encouragement, very little sort of optimism over the nomination of Liz Truss as prime minister. I think also everyone, because everyone is very much aware that she is a lightweight on the international stage, including actually with European partners. I mean, remember just a few weeks ago, she said of France, which is, even though Britain is no longer in the EU, it nevertheless remains a close partner with France. And she said that the jury was out whether Macron was a friend of Britain or not, which is, in diplomatic terms, it's a major blunder, in particular at a time where all European countries have literally forged a front to confront Russia. So we're seeing a woman who has very little, who's not effective, who's in essence incompetent. And I think on the back of that, many world leaders not trying to put too much spotlight on her, and in order to show that they're not going to rely too much on Britain as long as this woman is in charge. And obviously, fortunately, the idea is that she won't be in charge for too long, hence there is no real alarm bells ringing.
Well, Mahmoud Rafat, back in September, this is what happened when Liz Truss met the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken for the first time. She questioned the special relationship, and she even said that she had seen only a few tangible examples to support the idea of this relationship to be unique, where she said Britain has better relations with Canada, Japan, and Mexico. So basically it came down to what the U.S. has done for the U.K. lately type approach. Kind of goes against what you said earlier about this relationship.
Yes, well, the United States will never mind or will never put any obstacle for the Western states in general to be, I mean, European Union countries, Canada, Australia, all the West package to get complementarity, to get prosperity, to have their trade to evaluate and to get developed. That the United States will never put opposition on that, because it's at the end that to strengthen the West, and just when the West is strong, the background and the backyard of the United States is strong by the strength of its allies. So that will never be opposite. But and I'm talking about some cases. Look, for example, let me give a small example, the terrorism. Until our day-to-day, there is no one definition for the terrorism, despite we have a country like France, it's one of the oldest law states. We have a country like Italy, it's one of source of law along the history. Why? Because the United States, opposite to the Western world and the human rights world, to put a definition for the terrorism in order to play as according to its interest with this idea. I'm just giving this example sure. To understand that the West is not really allowed to go that far away from the decision and the frame of the United States. And this is, by the way, this is not a specificity on Americans. All winners of last world war and big empire ships along the history behaved like that. They gathered their allies around them, and the allies played followers in specific cases and in specific matters. So this is something in the international relations that I just wanted to highlight on. Let me go back just to Madame Truss. Madame Truss, well, now, even without the dilemma of Ukraine, but somehow and indirectly related to the dilemma of Ukraine, the economic situation in Europe, the shortage of gas while we are very close of winter, and the most important thing, that the way of treatment of this issue, of this matter, I mean, the gas matter, the energy matter. Now, a few days ago, Minister of Economy of Germany announced, oh, hey, we have 82% in our stock now, so we are fine, we are safe. Russia cut the gas. Okay. That means the 82 can go up until 50% or even less before the winter, which is a real catastrophe on Europeans. Just yesterday, only yesterday, the Sunday, the journal, non-journal Sunday, put a comparison. Everything in UK rise the price, and everything in Russia, which is under sanction, that its prices got down, decreased its prices, like okay. food, energy, medication, everything. So that reflects something. The Prime Minister of UK, Liz Truss, is coming with paralyzed hand, literally paralyzed.
Okay, I understood your point there. All right. Well, let's move on beyond Ukraine and the obviously the domestic challenges. That's a whole nother topic for a program here, Hafsa Karamustafa. But let's move on in the foreign policy arena. Of course, they might somewhat converge somehow, but let's talk about China. Now, she is very hot.
Much of what you're saying.
Go ahead. Do you have my voice? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, but it breaks up. Please go ahead.
I'm sorry. I want to ask you about China, what you think about the hawkish approach that she obviously has towards China, not only calling for a global NATO to defend Taiwan, but also for the first time, she may come out and classify China as a threat to British national security.
That's a good point. I think we have to distinguish between Liz Truss campaigning and Liz Truss as a prime minister. As a campaigner, and obviously because she's actually a professional turncoat. She was a Remainer and then became a Brexiteer. She was a Republican and then became a monarchist. So as a campaigner, she's obviously tried to appeal to some of the base of the Tory base in order to sort of stand up and come across as very firm and everything. But of course, once in power, she becomes faced with the real politics. And Britain, like my fellow panelists said, is no longer the world heavyweight it once was many, many decades ago. I think there's no way in any way that Britain can stand up and can be this hawkish towards a country that is now not only a superpower in military terms and in nuclear terms, but even in terms of its population. So I think these were words merely for the campaign trail and for the sort of the average Tory voter, knowing that these were the people who were going to get her nominated as prime minister. But I think once in number 10, she does realize that what she said then will not apply. And she's used to that tactic. So I think there's not much to worry about in terms of Britain's relationship or hawkishness towards China.
Sure. Well, West Asia, or the Middle East region, as some like to call it, is the next issue that is going to fall into her laps there, Masoud Rafat or Mahmoud Rafat. And I'm going to go with your guess as to how she has said that human rights, even though she's going to hold Persian Gulf countries to account, she said, well, it's more important to do business with them. So does that mean she's going to put that before military sales, for example? What do you think?
Well, I don't think the new prime minister will give big attention to the human rights. Let me also put a spot on a reality that we have been noticing in the West last, let's say, 7 or 8 years since what happened in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood somehow. I do not want to use any term here because I do not have any situation against that to be coup d'etat or whatever, or changement of president or revolution, whatever. Since this time, since 2013, that means 9 years ago, we have been noticing that the West in general reduced the value of the human rights because this card is no longer lucrative on the table. It used to be very lucrative to employ it against the regime of Mubarak, against Iran, against some countries here and where. Since 2013, somehow, and which is very contradictional, it happened, this decision was taken during the administration of President Obama himself, who presented himself as active of human rights. This card became not useless, but not that lucrative anymore on the table in the international relations. It's no longer the card which brings lots of benefits. That's why the West in general gave its back to the human rights, and that we have been witnessing that in lots of areas around the world, what happened in Saudi Arabia and President Biden, who came somehow on the legitimacy that of he will do 1, 2, 3 with Saudi Arabia, and then we found them inside Saudi Arabia. What we saw also what happened with Israel and what has been happening with Israel, not what happened, but what has been happening, and allowing Israel to go more and more, deeper and deeper in the Palestinian blood and the settlement, which is the Palestinian land. So the question of human rights will not be the main interest.
Okay.
Maybe she will export some slogans, as usual, but on the camp of application, there will not be real application.
Very well. Well, human rights goes hand in hand when it comes to the occupied territories. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, she's obviously behind Israel on this. One example, when the war happened in August and Palestinians were being killed, children included, and women, she said the UK stands by Israel and its right to defend itself. So we know where that stands. What do you think? There's not going to be any difference, really, if we want to take a look between her and the way that perhaps Boris Johnson approached Israel.
Yes, I agree. I mean, unfortunately, that's where she'll probably likely to flex her muscles. I think, given that the Palestinians obviously don't have a state and they don't have the superpower that the other countries that she's flexing her muscles with doesn't apply to Palestine. And also, given that the Arab world is very fractured on that topic, especially since the Abraham Accords. So I think on that is the only area, sadly, where she's likely to sort of show hawkishness. And she's already promised that she would consider, she saw very favorably the idea of Jerusalem being considered the official capital of Israel by Britain. And I think given the power and the weight of the pro-Israel lobby domestically, that is also likely to impact her decision, because obviously, as once again, given that she is an opportunistic political lightweight, she is likely to go wherever there is support, wherever there is likely to be benefit for her. And we have seen in the past 2 years how the pro-Israel lobby destroyed Corbyn over the course of his mandate as Labour leader, that they're very much likely to view anyone who blindly supports Israel favorably and support them all the way. And therefore, she knows that that's where her bread is going to be buttered. So she's very much likely to continue in this very pro-Israel stance, which is that of the Tory party and which was that of Boris Johnson in any case.
Well, we need to talk about Iran, Mahmoud Rafat, and what she has said, which was interesting in a sense, and at the same time pretty shocking, was the fact that when it comes to the sanctions removal talk, she said, "I have been clear that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not moving fast enough." And then she says, this is the shocking part, "I assure you that if the JCPOA collapses, all options are on the table." Tell us what you think about the way that she has approached Iran with that kind of a statement. And I'd like to put that into the context of how, when it comes to her mentality, this is one of the most shocking things that she has said, and that is the fact that when it came to nuclear weapons, she said she would be ready to launch nuclear weapons as prime minister. And here she makes that statement on Iran.
Well, Madam Liz Truss, the new prime minister of the UK, is known to be a changing person, unstable person. She doesn't have one line to walk on. And that reflects somehow a very high level of pragmatism. But this pragmatism is not well-directed. That means she's not, for example, the former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, who unified Germany by his pragmatism. No, her pragmatism is just to win immediately. What's winning the situation? And again, let me go back to the beginning of my speech. In the case of negotiations with Iran and the situation with Israel, her Europeans are not real decision makers. They can take very small decisions, and they have very narrow space to move in. Like to announce this is against international law to build the new settlements, but not really to condemn and to cut the relationship and to withdraw ambassadors and to help Palestinians and to push the International Criminal Court to trial war crimes in Israel committed by Israeli soldiers and army against Palestinians. That will never happen. They will not go because until this level, they did not have that big space.
Sure.
This
is the point. We're quickly running out of time. I'm sorry. Let me just address the last question to Hafsakar Mustafa. Our guest there has said, Hafsakar Mustafa, on numerous occasions that the EU as a whole and the UK as part of it, as part of Europe, doesn't have that much say. Now, I'm curious as to how much that's going to hold, given the precarious and fragile state that Europe as a whole is in, if the U.S. is leading it, and if that mentality that our guest there has is correct. Do you agree with his approach on the EU as a whole? If you heard my question.
I'm afraid I've only caught a few breaks of your question, but I mean, in substance, I think we have to also view the situation in light of the energy crisis that is looming. Britain is facing major disruption, and I think there is talk of major protests on a very wide scale in the coming months over the price of energy, which is now being blamed on the crisis in Ukraine. I think if the situation continues, and if we people on the streets, the average Briton doesn't see its politicians willing to make sacrifices and deal with governments that they don't like, I think the reaction is going to be very violent on the street. And I think that's one thing that we need to take into account, even in regards to Iran, which is a gas producer.
Thank you for that. Hafsakar Mustafa, journalist and political commentator from London. And Mahmoud Rafat, thank you, president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, this is goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards patience and fortitude. The one who has eloquently said, "Be aware that all good works bear praise, and they bear commendation and bring about a good reward." Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his dialogues. Imam al-Husayn's recitation of the Holy Quran on the eve of Ashura. And let not those who disbelieve think that our granting them respite is better for their souls. We grant them respite only so that they may add to their sins, and they shall have a disgraceful chastisement. On no account will Allah leave the believer in the condition which you are in until he separates evil from good.
As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdillah wa ala al-arwah allati حلت بفنائي عليك مني.
Dear audience, now let's listen to some parts of زيارة الناحية المقدسة. Stay tuned.
وبقي الليل والنهار. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام على الحسين الذي سمحت نفسه بمهجته.
Peace be upon al-Husayn, who sacrificed himself up to the last drops of the blood of his heart.
السلام على من أطاع الله في سره وعلانيته.
Peace be upon him who obeyed Allah secretly and openly.
السلام على من جعل الله الشفاء في تربته.
Peace be upon whom Allah placed a cure in the soul of his place of martyrdom.
السلام على من الإجابة تحت قبته.
Peace be upon the one under whose dome answer to supplications is guaranteed.
السلام على من الأئمة من ذريته.
Peace be upon the one in whose descendants are the Imams after him.
As-salamu ala ibn khatim al-anbiya. As-salamu ala ibn sayyid al-aghsiya.
Peace be upon the son of the seal of the prophets. Peace be upon the son of the chief of the executors.
As-salamu ala ibn fatimah al-zahra. As-salamu ala ibn Khadijah al-Kubra.
Peace be upon the son of Fatima, the radiant. Peace be upon the son of Khadija, the great.
As-salamu ala ibn Sidrat al-Muntaha. As-salamu ala ibn Jannat al-Ma'wa. As-salamu ala ibn Zamzam wa Safa.
Peace be upon the son of the lotus tree in the outermost boundary of heaven. Peace be upon the son of the Garden of Refuge. Peace be upon the son of Zamzam and As-Safa.
As-salamu ala al-murammali bid-dima.